The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you, Andy. We actually have very little time. 40 minutes strikes me as being like 2 minutes. So I'm going to do a short reading, and then I'm much after having a Q&A with you. I find that more engaging, and after all, you can read the book yourselves. So you can ask me about Life of Pi if you want. I'm going to read from Beatrice and Virgil, which is my most recent novel. To very quickly set it up, Henry is a writer. Erasmus is his dog. He's met a taxidermist who's been working for years on a play, and he sent to Henry extracts of that play. Henry goes to visit him because he's intrigued, and he's now visiting his taxidermy shop, and he's wandering around it, and this is what happens. Henry started going around the store. The taxidermist stayed in place, silent and staring. No, this is the wrong page, sorry. It looked kind of different. Okay. Well, he does go around and stares at all the animals. An impulse of pity made him think he should buy a stuffed animal. He had noticed the platypus tucked away on a shelf, but it wasn't for sale. It was appealingly mounted on a dark wood base, floating 2 inches above it, webbed feet outstretched, as if the strange little animal were swimming along a riverbed. Henry wanted to touch its bill, but refrained. Among the displays of skeletons, there was a remarkable skull. Hovering under a glass dome at the end of a golden rod, it had the appearance of a holy relic. The bone shone bright white, and there was power to that whiteness, as there was to the stare of the large eyeball sockets. Henry made his way back to the front of the store, Erasmus at his side. "How much are the tigers, out of curiosity?" he asked. The taxidermist moved to the counter, pulled open a drawer, and brought out a notebook. He flipped through some pages. "The female in the cub, as I said, are from Van Ingen and Van Ingen, a firm in India. In addition to being fine specimens, superbly mounted, they're also antiques. Together with the male, that would be..." The taxidermist cited a figure. Henry whistled in his head. At that price, if those animals had wheels, they'd be a sports car. "And the cheetah?" The notebook was again consulted. "It sells for..." And the taxidermist stated another figure. "Two wheels this time, a sleek, powerful motorcycle." Henry looked at a few more animals. "This is all fascinating. I'm glad I came, but I don't want to keep you any longer." "Wait!" Henry froze. He wondered if all the animals had also tensed. "Yes," he said. "I need your help," the taxidermist said. "Ah, yes, my help. You mentioned that in your letter. What exactly did you have in mind?" Henry wondered if the man was going to make him a business proposition. He had invested small sums here and there, mostly in ventures that had failed. Was he now going to find himself investing in a taxidermy concern? The thought intrigued him. He rather liked the idea of being involved with all these animals. "Please come to my workshop," the taxidermist said, signaling with his wide hand at the side door, to the side door. There was something commanding about the gesture. "Sure," said Henry, and he walked through. The workshop was smaller than the showroom, but better lit. A barred window cut across the back wall above a double door, letting in natural light. A faint smell of chemicals hung in the air. A chain was hanging from the wall with a hook at the end of it. There were animals again, on shelves and on the floor, though far fewer than in the display room, and some were entirely disembodied, just a pile of hide or a mound of feathers, and others were works in progress. A mannequin made of wood, wire, and cotton batting for a round animal, a large bird likely, lay unfinished on a work table. At the moment, the taxidermist appeared to be working on a deer head mount. The skin was not yet properly fitted on the fiberglass mannequin head, and the mouth was a tongueless, toothless, gaping hole, revealing the yellow fiberglass jaw of the mannequin. The eyes had that same yellow glow. It looked grotesquely unnatural, a servine version of Frankenstein. A desk stood in the corner of the room opposite the door. On top of it, among various papers and items, Henry noticed a dictionary and an old electric typewriter. The taxiderms apparently had no interest in new technologies. The desk had one wooden chair. The taxidermist sat in it. "Please," he said. He indicated the only other place to sit, a plain stool in front of the desk. Without worrying any further about Henry's comfort, he pulled a cassette player from a drawer. Henry sat down. The taxidermist set the player on the desk and pressed the rewind button. There was a whir, a blocking sound, a moment of strain, then the rewind button popped up. He pressed the play button. "Listen closely," he said. At first, Henry could hear only a grainy sound as an old tape rubbed against a tired head. Then another sound emerged, at first distant, then coming through in waves with greater clarity. It was a clamoring chorus of barked grunts. These went on for some several seconds, until suddenly, from their midst, drowning them out, a new and distinctive shout erupted. It was loud and continuous, a robust howl that kept increasing in volume until it reached a prolonged and formidable roaring pitch, vaguely like someone waking up and stretching and letting off a mighty growl, only someone superhuman, Nimrod, a titan, Hercules. It had a deep, throaty timbre, and it was very powerful. Henry had never heard anything like it. What emotion did it express? Fear? Anger? Lament? He couldn't tell. Erasmus seemed to know. As soon as he heard the barked grunts, he stiffened and his ears pricked up. Henry thought it was plain curiosity. But the dog seemed to be trembling. When the howl started, he burst into barking. He, too, was either afraid or angry. Henry bent down and picked Erasmus up and squeezed him to his chest to silence him. "I'm sorry," he said to the taxidermist. "I'll just be a second." He hurried to the showroom and tied Erasmus to the leg of the till counter. "Shh," he said to the dog. He returned to the shop. "What was that?" he asked, sitting on the stool again and pointing at the cassette player. "It's Virgil," replied the taxidermist. "Who?" "They're both here." The taxidermist indicated what he meant with a nod of his head. In front of his desk, set next to the wall, stood a stuffed donkey with a stuffed monkey sitting on its back. "Beatrice and Virgil? From the play you sent me?" Henry asked. "Yes, they were once alive." "You wrote that?" "Yes, what I sent you is the opening scene." "The two characters are animals?" "That's right, like in your novel. Beatrice is the donkey, Virgil is the monkey." So he was the author of the play after all. A play featuring two animals that have an extended conversation about a pair. Henry was surprised. He would have picked realism as the taxidermist's favorite style of representation. Evidently, he was misjudging him. Henry looked at the dramatis personae standing next to him. They were exceptionally lifelike. "Why a monkey and a donkey?" he asked. The taxidermist replied, "The howler monkey was collected by a scientific team in Bolivia. It died in transit. The donkey came from a petting zoo. It was hit by a delivery truck. A church was thinking of using it for a nativity scene. Both animals happened to arrive on the same day at my shop. I had never prepared a donkey before, nor a howler. But the church changed its mind, and the scientific institute decided it didn't need the howler. I kept the deposits and the animals. That happened on the same day, too, their abandonment, and the two animals came together in my mind. I finished preparing them, but I've never displayed them, and they're not for sale. I've had them for some 30 years now. Virgil and Beatrice, my guides through hell." "Hell? What hell?" Henry wondered. But at least now he understood the connection to the Divine Comedy. Dante is guided through Inferno and Purgatory by Virgil, and then through Paradise by Beatrice. And what would be more natural for a taxidermist with literary aspirations than to fashion his characters out of what he worked with every day? So, of course, he would use talking animals. So there is this play that the taxidermist has been working on for a number of years, and they feature two characters, Beatrice and Virgil, Beatrice being the donkey, Virgil the monkey. And you only get fragments of the play in the novel. So I'm going to read a brief extract of that play. Beatrice, I've had enough of lists. Virgil, so have I. Beatrice sighs, lays her head down, and falls asleep. Virgil wanders off. In the bushes, he finds a large piece of cloth, bright red and patternless. Is it a tablecloth? A bolt of fabric? Virgil picks it up and plays with it. He waves it about, throws it in the air and watches it fall, wraps himself in it. Then he falls back and starts wrestling with it, the red cloth above him and he on the ground on his back. Suddenly, he stops and turns to the audience. Virgil. Someone is dying, and as they are dying, they grab at the red cloth of suffering, and they pull and tear at it, and nothing before in their life has involved them so completely emotionally or overwhelmed them with such crushing intellectual totality. I'm dying. I'm dying. So the cloth becomes everything they see and feel, covering the walls and ceiling of their room, or, if they're dying in the open, filling the entire dome of the sky, but getting closer by the minute until the red cloth of suffering clings to their body like clothing, only tighter. Then clings like a shroud, only tighter. Then clings like embalming bands, only tighter. Until the red cloth chokes them and they breathe their last, at which moment the cloth, as if pulled by a magician, vanishes, and there's only a body left, surrounded by people whose very pulsing being has made them incapable of seeing the cloth. And life goes on, triumphant, one might say, until the day the red cloth flutters into your view, and you realize it's coming your way, and you wonder, with utter disbelief, how you could have missed seeing it before, how you could have ignored it, but your contemplations are cut short, because you've already fallen back and started wrestling with the red cloth of suffering, pulling and tearing at it. Virgil wrestles with the red cloth. Beatrice, waking up. What are you doing? Virgil, stopping instantly. Nothing, just folding this piece of cloth. He folds the cloth into a neat rectangle and puts it down. Beatrice, where did you find it? Virgil, pointing. There. Beatrice, I wonder how it got there. Virgil, I don't know. Silence. Virgil, we could do with a little good cheer. Beatrice, we could. Virgil, something funny. Beatrice, something very funny. Virgil, but not empty good cheer. Beatrice, no. Thank you. So as I said, I'm quite happy having questions. There is, I think I see two volunteers because they have pale blue T-shirts. They have roving mics. So if you have questions, you're happier to answer them. If you could just wait for the people to bring the mics to you, because all of this is being taped. While someone dares to break the ice, I'll just say it's the first time I'm here at the Free Library. And often in America, I find the use of free and freedom is weirdly inappropriate, like freedom fries. But freedom and free with, in terms of books, a free library, that's a magnificent name. And I gather it's just your public library, but that's a great institution. What a great location. Sir, I think you had a question.
It says here you were going to talk about the limitations of language and understanding and describing the horrors of the Holocaust. Could you say something? Is that correct? And if so, say
something. That's news to me, but I can't. I can talk to you about that if you want. Yes, the book, Beatrice and Virgil, despite what the appearance of what I just read, is inspired by the Holocaust, is about the Holocaust, however you want to put it. What I'm trying to do, first of all, I have to say I'm not Jewish, I'm not of Eastern European descent. I have absolutely no direct familial connection to the Holocaust. I'm from Quebec, I'm French-Canadian. But both sides of my parents, of my families, have been in Quebec for over 300 years. So even my roots in France are incredibly distant. So I have no connection whatsoever to the Holocaust. But it's a drama that's always been with me. I'll describe it using an analogy. I think when we're born, we're like a puzzle piece. And very quickly, things start snapping into place around us. So, you know, very quickly we're taught language, and that snaps into place. Language is useful, and it comes naturally. And then, we're taught basic arithmetic, and that snaps into place. Then we're taught basic social skills. And then you go to school and you're taught history and geography. And those also start constructing your social and your national persona. You are, you're given a historical, a nation-founding myth that is part of which you are a part. And you're taught geography, and that sets you at sort of at your spot on planet Earth. So, you know, when you say the USA, you all of the collectively have this map in your head divided in 50 states. So as I said, your consciousness is like this expanding puzzle. And things either snap into place right away or you grow into it. You know, if you're not good at calculus, you know, it grows into you with great difficulty. And maybe you just give up and that part of the puzzle is like a smooth edge and you're happy with that. We don't all have to be advanced mathematicians. So if consciousness is like a puzzle piece, I lived in France as a child for a number of years, and I very vividly remember my history teacher teaching us of about the Second World War. And as he was teaching us about the Second World War, he was teaching us about the Holocaust. And whereas war, once again, snaps into place very easily, children understand war at an intuitive level. They hate, oh, there's someone doing sign language. My God, I'm speaking so quickly. Sorry. Children intuitively understand war. You know, I hate my brother, and the World War II is just, you know, my hate of my brother writ large and involving a lot more people. So children play war. The Holocaust didn't fit that way. It didn't snap into place. Kids don't play genocide. And it was just puzzling. Whereas there's a certain logic to war. You know, we perceive some wars, and they are rightly so necessary wars. The Second World War, for example, was a necessary war. The Holocaust didn't fit there. So it was a sort of a ragged, in my consciousness, it was a sort of this ragged bit where the puzzles did not fit. And as I grew a bit older and I read about it, I was deeply moved. Now, sounding that perhaps sounds a bit pious. But I do think that the terms we use to describe that immense tragedy tend to be like a box. And we label it and we slightly become desensitized. So the word Holocaust, which is in fact this innocuous religious term, which curiously has been appropriated to describe this drama, that sort of nearly copyrighted number, 6 million, Auschwitz, Final Solution, we get used to that. And of course, that's normal. We get used to anything. But what happened with me is, in a reoccurring fashion, I noticed the millions and millions of details. So, you know, 6 million victims is 6 million first names. It's 6 million individuals who had aspirations and appetites. One quarter of the victims were children. And so just periodically as I was growing up and reading, I kept on coming back to the Holocaust and wanting to comment on it. But finding I had no entry point because I'm not Jewish. So I had no village in the Ukraine I could go to like Jonathan Safran Foer. I certainly had no camp I could go to where a grandfather of mine or grandmother might have, you know, survived. I was a complete outsider. And eventually, as a result of writing Life of Pi, I sort of said, well, what if I try to approach it? Why even pretend to approach it in a historical fashion, in a literal witness fashion? Why don't I approach it with obviously artistic means? Which also strikes me as appropriate, because one thing I noticed also in my readings of the Holocaust is it is very rarely portrayed in ways other than historical, literal, anecdotal, factual. If you think of it, the great writers of the Holocaust are all writers of nonfiction. They're either survivors, so Primo Levi, Elie Wiesel, or those who died, like Anne Frank, or they're the historians. Historians, to a remarkable extent, dominate the discussion of the Holocaust. There's no evil there, by the way. These are all necessary texts. But it's surprising how little genuine fiction there is in the Holocaust. And by fiction, I mean the true sense of fiction, of discovering the truth by other means than the factual, than the realistic, than the literal. Elie Wiesel at one point said, you know, I'm going to poorly paraphrase here, but it was something about, you know, a novel about Auschwitz is either not a novel or not about Auschwitz. And so I was also intrigued, why the suspicion of the imagination in approaching the Holocaust? And so that questioning And this idea of using animals nicely coincided for me, and I said, okay, here we go. I can't approach it in human disguise. Perhaps I can approach it in animal disguise, which would also be a way of approaching it, discussing it, through the imagination rather through the than through the factual. So Beatrice and Virgil aspires to allegory. It aspires to look at the Holocaust using the tools of the imagination. So irony, allegory, all these. So the novel throws all kinds of literary devices. Allegory, for example, you know, in the extract that I read, you understand why the characters are called Beatrice and Virgil. There is a play throughout it. Why? Because plays are oral. And in my looking at the Holocaust, I was struck at how the spoken word was the truest word. Written words are written words can be highly manipulative. You know, great writers, in a sense, are great manipulators. They make you believe these little black prints on the page, and they really take you in, which, of course, is fantastic. But when it comes to a great tragedy, I've always been struck how what people say spontaneously, whether they're articulate or not, carry so much emotional weight. So I wanted something that was very oral. And also, as I said, I wanted to approach it non-historically, and the Holocaust is very highly historicized and also very precisely set geographically. When you think of the Holocaust, you merely start imagining hinterlands of Poland, where Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and all these camps were. Whereas if it's set on a stage, what's nice about a stage is a stage could be anywhere. Every stage in the world pretty well looks the same. There are different kinds of stages, but essentially this stage, this exact same stage, could be in Paris, Berlin, Moscow, Sydney, Australia, could be anywhere. So I like the universality of that. So that's why there's this play, and the play is fragmented because the lives of the people that were lost in the Holocaust were themselves fragmented. We get little tiny fragments. Also in the book, there are a lot of other literary references, some of which are perhaps fairly obvious in why they're there, others not. For example, there's a long extract of a short story by Gustave Flaubert, the French writer from the 19th century, who wrote and existed long before the Holocaust. The play is sort of Samuel Beckett, kind of, in its setup. There's also a reference to Denis Diderot, another French writer. So I'm throwing all these different tools to try to approach it non-literally. And the reason I want to do that is because the strength of art is to get to the essence of things. History is very heavy, it's full of details, and it's often incomprehensible. What's great about art is that it can get to the essence and convey it in a very compact form and also in a way that provides its own context. So whereas a biography of Andrew Jackson would be only of interest to people who are specifically interested in U.S. presidential history, a novel based on the life of Andrew Jackson might be of interest to anyone. A great novel appeals to anyone and can be read on its own. So I'll give you another example, a more obvious example. The Death of Ivan Illich by Leo Tolstoy. It's an amazing novella set in provincial Russia in the 19th century. It's about Ivan Illich, who one day is putting up a curtain rod, and he sort of missteps, and he bangs his side, and his side hurts for several days. And he says, "Oh, just go away. I'm a vigorous man in my 40s. And it doesn't go away. It just keeps on hurting more and more. And eventually, Ivan Illich starts dying. And the novella is about his death, and about how he feels about it, how the people around him feel about it, and the appalling callousness of most of the people about him. Now, that novel, that novella, could be read in translation literally by anyone on this planet, and it will speak to them, even if they know nothing about Russia, nothing about the mores of provincial Russians in the 19th century, even if the descriptions of the furniture might be obscure to someone who's a tribesman in the south of Africa. The human emotional content is universal. So art is very good at that, providing its content, its own context, and conveying the essence of the human experience. And so I think we need to discuss the Holocaust in fictional terms so that its message can be transmitted in ways other than simply that of the great memoirists and the great historians. There, does that answer your question? Yes?
I was wondering if in the beginning of the book, how much of Henry's experience when he's sitting at the table in England was your experience, and if you could talk about the flip book, and if that was something that you proceeded forward with, or if it was just an idea that existed in the book.
She's asking, a young lady was asking about a scene at the beginning of the novel where Henry the writer meets his editors in England during the London Book Fair, and they reject the book he's been working on for 5 years. And that book, to sort of describe it, is a flip book. Now, a flip book is usually a gimmick. A flip book is a book with two front covers. And if you flip through it like this, you eventually get to pages that are upside down. So in other words, it's two sets of distinct pages brought together, glued together, back to back, upside down. So here's one book, and if you keep on reading, you get to pages that are upside down because you have to flip it over to get to the other book. You see it very, very rarely. Dave Eggers had one of his books, or an edition of one of his books, that was kind of in a flip book format. Henry, the writer in the book, works for 5 years on a flip book on the Holocaust, one side being a novel, one side being an essay. And he does that because it's extremely rare to have books that combine fiction and nonfiction. We just separate them. You separate them in libraries, you separate them in bookstores, and we kind of separate them in our way of thinking. And so it seemed funny to have one after the other, fiction, nonfiction. So he has this flip book, and he meets his editors, and they think the idea stinks. And they basically hate everything about his book, the novel, the essay. And so what happens as a result of that is Henry just stops writing. Now, I did have a meeting with my editors in London. It wasn't half that brutal. I did work on a flip book, and I did let it go. Their argument wasn't that my book stank. Their argument was that nonfiction is a drag on fiction. As I said here, I was giving an example of Leo Tolstoy. You know, if you republished the Death of Ivan Illich, and on the back you had a study of provincial mores in Minsk in 1852. It's very unlikely that people would be interested about, you know, the mores of Minsk in 1852. So they were afraid that it would drag the novel down. And they also said, if you append an essay on the Holocaust to a novel, people will necessarily read that novel as a novel on the Holocaust. And it's best, I was talking about the word freedom, it's best if we read fiction with freedom, interpreting it any which way we want. So this novel, for example, you could also very easily read it as being a metaphor, an allegory on the destruction of the environment. The taxidermist deals with animals. He talks about animals. His two characters are animals. He's concerned about animals. Other than Henry in his little book at the beginning, there's hardly any reference at all to the Holocaust. And that's fine. It's a book works when the reader brings something to it. An actual book is only 50%. The other 50% is what you bring to it when you read it. And that's what really makes it a complete experience and a unique one, and one that is so powerful, which is why a great novel is the best form of representation of the past. Nothing can beat a novel. I don't know why I'm obsessively talking about Russia, but, you know, nothing will capture 19th century Russia than the great novelists of the 19th century. Nothing. No painting, no music. To recapture that past experience, the history of it, the smells of it, the colors, the behaviors, than a great, great novel. And so they thought, why append it with an act of nonfiction that will box it in? So it wasn't half as brutal. But the reason I have it in here, by the way, is not just to be autobiographical. I'm not interested in autobiography. It's because it suited my purpose to have a writer who stops writing, who then meets a playwright who cannot write anymore, who's also stalled. Those two people, paralyzed in their words, struck me as the right attitude when confronting the Holocaust, which famously robs people of their tongue. Famously, people go to places of the where the Holocaust took place, and they say, you know, it is unimaginable. You know, testimony too, it always is steeped in words of disbelief. There are no words for. I could not believe what I was looking at. It's very difficult to attach words to it. They always seem to slide off, and there's that temptation of silence, which you see. At one point I mentioned in this novel, only 2% of survivors of the Holocaust testify in any way to their ordeal, whether it's writing about it or speaking about it. Only 2%. And if you think, it's a huge effort to express oneself verbally, especially in writing. So of these 2%, even fewer are good at words, and a great number fall into cliché, which is not necessarily helpful. So we need to throw as many words as we can at that event and see how many stick. And that's why I think we have to start not so much taking liberties, because that sounds like I have an agenda, but I just think we have to try to take as many approaches, represent the Holocaust as many different ways as possible to squeeze out the reality of it, which is what we do with war, for example. The Second World War cost the lives of 20 million people by conservative estimates that only on the Allied side. So not talking about the Axis deaths, not talking of the Jewish deaths, 20 million. And yet we have no problem inventing war comedies, war romances, war thrillers. In other words, we have no problems denaturing the real nature of war for other purposes, some of which are mere entertainment, and others, are ironic. And we do that and we feel comfortable because that's, in these many, many ways of talking about war, we get to our sense of what we feel about war. I don't think we take those representational liberties with the Holocaust. You get this sort of representational orthodoxy, and I don't think it serves it. If you always have the same kinds of stories about the Holocaust, typified by a survival story of living somewhere in Poland or Hungary and then ending up on a train and ending up at a death camp, that's absolutely accurate, and we need to know that, and those books are vital. But at one point, with the passage of time, I suspect a certain automatic reaction sets in, a certain, okay, here we go again, been there, done that, unless they occasionally take a different approach. So Art Spiegelman with Maus, was a huge success, even though it's actually quite a conventional Holocaust story of his father and his survival of the Holocaust, it's told in an unusual format. First of all, it's a graphic novel, which we normally thought of as being for children, and then this very ingenious use of animals. The Jews have the face of mice, the Nazis of cats. That sort of renewed our approach to it. I think we have to do more of that. Lady right in front there. Oh, two? Okay.
I want to change the subject. I have not read The Life of Pi. Why should I?
You haven't read The Life of Pi, and should I shoot you? Is that what you said?
No.
Well, is that what I heard?
Why should I read it?
Oh, why should you read it? Oh. Well, first of all, it's called, just a minor correction, it's called Life of Pi. There's no the. Why should you read it? Well, you have no necessity to read it. You certainly have no obligation to read it. If you want to read it, well, why would you read Life of Pi? I guess if you want a bit of information about zoos, a bit of information about other religions, Hinduism, Islam. There's sort of Hinduism 101, Islam 101 in it. If you want my... The tiger, yeah. Well, if you like tigers, yeah. If you're interested... Life of Pi is about how we interpret life. To me, life is a series of facts, and we can interpret it in many, many ways. And you might as well interpret it in a transcendental way, a way that is greater than lesser. So it's about how one interprets life, and my argument is we are here for such a brief time, we might as well interpret it in a greater, not necessarily magical, that makes it sound like it's false, but a way that it somehow weaves into the fiber of existence more than less. That's sort of what it's about thematically. In one sentence, the story of a boy ends up in a lifeboat with a tiger in the Pacific after he's shipwrecked, and it's about his survival in the Pacific with that tiger. But there's no obligation. Yeah, really. Any other question? Oh, I think there's a lady there who had a question. Yeah. Oh, you got to wait for the mic. Otherwise, you will not go on to the...
You actually sort of answered one of my questions, which was what your interpretation of that book was, because we read it in our book group, and we had many interpretations. And so that's what I think is interesting about a metaphorical novel, is that it can take you many different ways. But my other question was, while you were writing it, did you have a specific interpretation in mind that changed as you wrote it, or did it, was it well plotted out throughout?
Good question. It was completely plotted out. I plan what I write. Some writers start a novel not knowing where it's going, and the characters speak to them, and Michael Ondaatje, for example, writes like that. He just starts and he sort of intuits his way to a completed novel. It's completely planned out. So right from the start, I knew it would have 100 chapters in three parts. prologue in which animal behavior and zoo biology and Pai's faith is explained, part two in the Pacific, part three the interrogation with the Japanese investigators. So before I wrote the author's note, I knew exactly how chapter 100 would end. And I knew all along that it was a story with one set of facts and two very differing interpretations, one story with animals, one without. So that was all planned out. In the Pacific, things changed a little bit as I wrote. I mean, you know, at one point, whales appeared. Was, you know, it doesn't really matter when they appeared in relation to when he sees dolphins or whatever. So at one point in the Pacific, the story is told in real time, and then we jump into remembered time. So we jump to sort of events rather than, you know, I think the first 7 days is, oh, Andy's coming. So it was very well planned out. That I believe in form, so it's very carefully planned out. He moved closer, so maybe one more question. I think the lady behind Andy.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about why animals? Why have you used animals in the way that you have?
And I'll be using them again. My next novel will feature three chimpanzees, and it's set in northeastern Portugal. I just find they work for me. I find that their symbolic potential is enormous. An animal can be both what it is. So, for example, it's just literally a tiger in a lifeboat, or a talking, or you know, a monkey or a donkey, and then it can be something else. And in that width that an animal can be, I just found it useful to tell stories. Whereas with human beings, we know our species very well. We're obsessed about ourselves, and so we're very cynical about ourselves. So, you know, that's why novelists spend sometimes so much time constructing character, because unless you're telling something that's very plot-driven, it'll be flimsy if you don't spend, you know, 100 pages fleshing out the character, which, if you're a great novelist, is an amazing accomplishment. But it also means, for example, in modern fiction, you get a lot of characters who are incredibly zany and strange and weird. And I think that's because we are cynical, and therefore, to make a story work, characters have to be weirder and weirder and stranger. Whereas, for example, in Life of Pi, Pi to me is, I mean, he practices three religions, which is odd, but otherwise is nearly anonymous. To me, Pi is just, you know, an average nice person. He happens to be Indian, he happens to have a family that has a zoo, but he's sort of a friendly narrator. Hopefully you as a reader just park behind his head and you look out through his eyes, but he's in no way particularly unusual. I never describe him because it really didn't matter to me what Pi looked like, and besides his religiosity, I never describe anything else. I think at one point I described that his favorite color is green, but other than that, whereas looking out at animals, I don't have to work on character. Because you know what an animal looks like, but in a novel, its character is entirely up to me to determine. And especially with wild animals, I find people suspend their disbelief and take in the character. So it's for that symbolic potential. And also I have the nice feeling that I'm not crowded in my field. For some reason, in adult fiction, and I do write adult fiction. I mean, Life of Pi, despite the fact that lots and lots of teenagers have read it, I wrote it strictly for adults. It is a story in which, you know, a mother gets her head cut off, if you believe the second version, and most people are hard-headed and believe the second version. In that second story, a mother gets her head cut off, her head is thrown at her son, and she gets partly eaten, and then thrown overboard and eaten by sharks. So it was a novel that I meant entirely for adults. And same thing with the Beatrice and Virgil, same thing with the next one. And I have a nice feeling of being alone. Whereas otherwise, animals are confined to children's literature. So there's also that feeling of sort of being all on my own, which is nice. One more question, Andy? One more question. I have stunned you into silence. Well, listen, thank you very much for coming, and I guess I'm signing somewhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.